Welcome back, everybody, after the coffee or tea break. Yesterday, we had a games fair, playing both professional war games and hobby war games. And if you look at us as an audience, many of us, or maybe the most of us, are hobby war gamers, professional war gamers, and many of us are both. This session will be about synergies between hobby wargaming and professional wargaming. So, in essence, it's about synergies between the work that we do as hobby wargamers and professional wargamers. It will be two presentations. First, Phil Sabin on the contemporary utility of wargames. And then John Curry on professional use of recreational wargames. Phil Sabin is a well-known person here, of course. He has developed several commercial war games and also some professional war games. The latest one was demonstrated yesterday to great success. But you also look a lot into Ancient Warfare, air power studies, and so on. And I'm really looking forward to hear your first presentation here. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Right, death by PowerPoint. Well, you'd be pleased to hear perhaps that other than these words, there are no words, only pictures, but of course we do have the obligatory diagram. You'll see that when it comes. I'm not also going to be talking about the implied message here, which is about the stigma of wargaming. We've decided we've talked enough about that, now we need to be upbeat and positive. So, who wants to actually play a game? That's Tom's... That is Tom. And it's his interpolation into my slides. Okay, so recreational gaming and professional gaming. One of the key dissonances between the two is the historical focus of hobby war games. 95% of hobby war games are on past conflicts, stretching all the way back to ancient times. And of course, pretty much the reverse is the case in terms of the balance of professional war games. That's some of my collection. From ancient times up to the 20th century. So, any synergy between the two needs to overcome that dissonance. A very high proportion of the hobby games focus on World War II. I wouldn't be surprised if it was approaching, if not exceeding, 50%. Why? Well, World War II, of course, especially for those in the early days of the hobby in the 50s and 60s, was the searing recent experience. And, of course, it's the biggest war that there had ever been, or has ever been, and hopefully that ever will be. You know, we will really know it if we ever have a war anything like as big as World War II. So whether you're talking about computer games or, as in this case, board games shown on the left, World War II is the great historical focus of hobby wargaming. What use are they for professional purposes? Well, of course, one obvious use would be to study the very past campaigns on which they are focused. And that's the primary way in which I myself use them. My two recent books, Lost Battles, about ancient warfare, and then Simulating War, with examples stretching from ancient times up to the end of World War II. Their primary focus is on designing games to be able to understand the historical battles or campaigns on which the games are focused. I do it, of course, as an active learning tool. That's one of my BA classes. You can see also some of my MA students who are helping out, but most of the students there are BAs, and they are learning, in this case, about World War II. That's what the course is about, and they're playing one of my games about the operational nature of encirclement operations on the Eastern Front as a means to an end of learning about that in its historical context. I've also used, to a more limited extent, historical games as a vehicle for studying counterfactual history, the what-ifs. Last year, I put together a centenary 1914 Kriegsspiel. Very similar principles to the Camberley Kriegsspiel that some of you saw yesterday. And you can see there the audience with which it was first played, including some of the people like General Andrew who were here, a mixture of academics and generals and so on. You can see John Kisley there as well if you look hard. and we were looking at the what-ifs of the 1914 campaign. But don't think from that that historians routinely use war games. They do not. I am very, very much the exception that proves the rule. And I have all sorts of problems because of that in getting acceptance for my techniques, especially as any kind of research insight rather than as a mere educational tool. So the $64,000 question is, how can historical war games help 95% of the attendees here who are interested in contemporary defence issues? And that's a shot, of course, of the test of our Camberley-Kriegspiel, which is focused, of course, on contemporary battlegroup operations. How can historical war games help an understanding of contemporary defence? Now, in one sense, it's very easy to answer, because, as we've learnt the rest of this conference, you really cannot understand the present and the future without understanding the past. The analysts among you will be familiar with both of those books, I'm sure, and certainly one of them, David Rowland's book and Stephen Biddle's book, interested in the dynamics of breakthrough operations, combat stress and so on, and integrally appealing to historical precedent and building on at least the past century of experience in trying to understand what may happen in the future, especially in terms of the human dimension. So it's not a case of needing to make a defence of history per se. The issue is, how can historical war games, as opposed to simply reading about history and analysing history, how can historical war games help in the contemporary world? There's one obvious example which was referred to by Jeremy a great deal this morning. That's one of the RCAT tests, indeed. That's the actual test. That's my office upstairs. And there you can see on the left are Julian Thompson and Mike Clapp, as we played through the Falklands and got their comments. So in order to see whether a system, generic system, focusing on the future has validity, you need to look back at, can it model recent campaigns like the ones that Jeremy mentioned? Hobby war games about potential future operations routinely include scenarios of historical fights. There's an old urban fighting game. Urban fighting, of course, has been an enduring issue and more these days. On the left from Joe Balkowski, and on the right, eagerly anticipated Sebastian de Perez game, which you were coming out any time now. Both hobby games, both of them focused on future contingencies, but both including a large range of historical scenarios to show that it does actually bear some relationship to observed reality. And again this morning you've heard about the utilisation of games. These are from Ivor Gardner's presentation last year. Ed Farron talked about similar things this morning. Using board games in this case to give his subalterns an idea of tactics and of how to work as a command team. And the game that's shown there is Advanced Squad Leader. There are all sorts of issues of, is it too advanced? Is it ridiculously complex? As I would think, but he's a great aficionado of complex games. But the point is, of course, which nobody really focuses on, because it doesn't matter that much, this is about World War II combat. But he still finds it very useful to have his people play the attack on Aachen in 1944 in order to achieve those leadership development and tactical objectives. Uwe Hellman, who's been mentioned once or twice in the conference, goes back even further. Uwe is there, standing up on the very left there, and he uses war games as far as possible from contemporary and future conflict, because he deliberately wants his leadership teams to cope with the unknown. He wants them to come to grips with a deeply unfamiliar tactical and strategic situation, in this case ancient warfare, using a derivation of the command and colour system. Not because they need to learn about ancient battles for their own sake, but because it's good for them to have to cope with an unfamiliar problem. It actually trains them to work together, to analyse quickly, and then to analyse future problems which may be equally as unfamiliar. again mentioned this morning, battlefield studies. Battlefield studies, going to visit, to walk the ground, are a key feature of military training. And people like Ivor Gardner, and again this is from his presentations last year, are starting to use war games. This is Leros, by the way, his people out in that island, starting to use war games of the particular campaign that they're going to study to give them some dynamic insights into the campaign to accompany and complement going out on the ground and reading the memoirs and so on. Here's the one diagram. Here's the obligatory diagram. And what this is saying, remember, I'm trying to say why historical war games are useful to you as opposed to just history. One great problem with history in its traditional format, books and so on, is that it can seem unduly determinist. We know what happened, and it's all too easy to believe that was bound to happen. People at the time didn't think that. Think about how we now envisage what's going to happen in Syria or Iraq. There's all sorts of possibilities. It'd be a brave man or woman who said they know exactly what is going to turn out. In the past, we do know what happened. War games, of course, by reopening those possibilities and reopening the counterfactual, can remind us that it was just the same for our predecessors in the past. The diagrams are from my Simulating War book, and it shows how war games, war game design particularly, forces us to engage with questions about how determined was the outcome. If you had 1,000 different universes, in how many of them would the outcome of that war resemble the one we actually had? And you see various possible distributions in that sort of multiple universe model. The most interesting, by the way, I find, and probably the most common, is the chaotic distribution, where most of the time it is roughly historical, but something can change it radically. And of course, war games can help us to tease out those chaotic mechanisms, the butterfly wings and so on. So I think war games are very good at highlighting contingent variation, which is all too easily forgotten studying traditional history where hindsight dominates. This is actually something that Ed put together based on a solitaire game that I designed actually many years ago. And it's set, the game is set in Market Garden, 1944, very first day of that. And it's an American company trying to get to a bridge and take the bridge against unknown opposition, and facing a dilemma. They don't know how strong the opposition is. If they go all out for the bridge, they might get cut to pieces, whereas if they hold back and be cautious, they'll get through the opposition, but the bridge might have blown. Okay, typical sort of military dilemmas. And the point is, as you can see from Ed's text on there on the left, very much capturing enduring military dynamics. World War II's fire and movement is not completely different from today's fire and movement that we were talking about earlier. So you can actually use explicitly historical games of this kind to illustrate enduring principles. I think a particular utility of history, and indeed of historical war games specifically, is they highlight the human factors. People who focus on novelty in modelling future operations tend to be focused on the technology. We have to understand the penetration of this weapon, the observation that we can get from this system and so on. The quantitative elements, the quantifiable elements. It takes only a rudimentary study of military history to find that those hard, physical, quantifiable elements are often not the most important factors in war. And because it's very difficult to quantify human factors, they tend to be downplayed in a purely future-oriented simulation divorced from any study of the past. The examples I've given here, just for topicality, by coincidence, two hobby war game designs, one by me, one by Lee, who hoped to be here, by the way, yesterday to demonstrate this, but he's ill, sadly, have been published this year. They're both grand tactical looks at World War II air combat, as you can see. But they bring out, because, of course, the historical record shows us, the importance of human factors. For example, the ACE factor. For example, fear. Both of us have had to grapple with the fact that only about 10%, if that, of the number of planes that engage in a dogfight get shot down. Why is that? It's not because it's physically impossible for the others to be shot down. And in many computer simulations, that will happen. One side will be utterly destroyed. It's because people don't want to lose their lives. Okay, and that can be incorporated in war games, especially top-down ones such as these. And then it prompts you to think, of course, about what are we missing out in terms of human factors of leadership and morale and the like from what might otherwise be unduly technically focused future games. One good thing about hobby games is they are accessible in the sense that you can go and you can buy them, whoever you are. Now, that shouldn't be underrated. I've actually given some examples here of hobby games, the 5%, which do look at future operations. And controversial, especially things like Drive on Pyongyang. And even though you can buy it, the military might not want to endorse it and say, yes, we must use this as a training tool. But playing history, of course, evades that kind of problem, problems of classification, problems of sensitivity. Not altogether, but at least you can, obviously not in Germany, for example, playing about the Second World War. So there are neuralgias that are there. But in most cases, it's more acceptable to play in an historical context than it is openly, in an unrestricted format, to play about these potential future scenarios. The ARCAT historical games, by the way, just to give you an instance, all three of those I was involved in. There have been a number of other ARCAT games of future operations. I haven't had the clearance, even though I was one of the people who contributed to the design. I haven't had the clearance even to attend those. All right. So there are merits in not being classified and not being too sensitive so that you can have the openness, which, of course, Connections is founded on. You know, of course, that for 12 years now I've been running an MA course. Some of the people who took that course are here today. And we explicitly in that course model known and understood conflicts of the past. Now, it can be the very recent past. We had one student who modelled a battle that had taken place literally a couple of months before he came on the course. Or it could go back all the way to ancient times. The point being, they learn to model what has happened. And so one can legitimately say, this isn't producing ever anything like what really happened, therefore there's something wrong. So it's this validation and verification point. The key issue, I think, here is, if you're going to try to teach people how to design war games, and you're focused on having them eventually design them about the future, if they can't design a war game about what's happened in the past and ever have what really happened in the past come into their war game, even though they've got a big clue because it's in the history books, they're probably not going to be very good at designing a war game about the future where the outcome is deeply uncertain. Okay. Here's some examples of often quite sophisticated products, even though it's only a short course, a single option within a year, that my students have produced. Two of the people, and in fact the two that produced the most historical of those, the Battle of Bautzen in 1813 and Afghanistan in the 1980s, are now working for MOD or DSTL. Indeed, one of them, Stephen Ho, who's been with us at this conference. Okay. So you do have this transferability of learning to model past conflicts and then going and doing it at the classified level within the defence community. Time's arrow. Contemporary games become historical games, but not vice versa. That's illustrated with regard to professional games there, all the way, of course, back to the original Kriegsspiel, modelling essentially Napoleonic warfare, and then through Vietnam and the 19th century and so on. You could make exactly the same point about hobby games, where there's a number of future games at the time, which are now obviously deeply obsolete because they were about the Cold War, NATO, Warsaw Pact, and so on. The point being, if you want to model only what might happen in our future, you've basically got to start from scratch almost every day because the corpus that has been designed in the past becomes obsolete. at least with historical games, it doesn't become obsolete. One can play a good game designed in the 1960s about World War II, and it will give you just as much utility as a game designed yesterday about World War II. The same is not true about games for the future, because, of course, we know now a lot more than they did in the 1960s about what warfare might be like in 2020. And finally, as the Hands Up showed earlier on, at the start of the conference, many of us here do it not only as a job, but we do it as a hobby in our spare time for fun. You can be spotting some key luminaries in some of the shots from recreational game activities or conventions there. And that, I think, is a very, very important bonus. The defence establishment is getting a huge free good from the fact that many, if not most, war game designers who work and do it within the classified realm, often professionally, do it for fun, engage with one another, have these discussions, and don't get paid for that, because it's their hobby, it's their recreation, do you see? So all I'm suggesting is we don't leave it purely as a recreation, we actually build on it for all the other reasons that I've said. Whoops. So where are we? A couple of illustrations, some of you may even appear in those. That's from last year, playing a simpler version of my 1914 Kriegsspiel with the Army and with last year's Connections Conference. So we are playing something there 100 years, based on a conflict 100 years ago. Does that mean that we can now go and buy all these cheap hobby board games which are now being published at a greater rate than ever before? And indeed the same is true of computer war games. Cornucopia of stuff out there, and we've solved our problem. Maybe, but that's not the only obstacle. This illustration shows a very simple game, indeed a deliberately simplified version of what was already a simple game. Most hobby games are vastly more complex and or very unrealistic. It's extremely rare to find a hobby game that can simply be taken off the shelf and played by non-gamers and that they will get the value that we all would like them to have. That's something which John will now build upon.
Thank you.